Hey guys, today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. I command you.
I got my city doing front flips. When every father may a rapper jump ship. I guess that's why they call it where I stay. Clean up the streets so my daughter can have somewhere to play. I'm the blueprint to a real man. Some of these niggas toss they tassel for a deal, man. I ain't going to hell or the hill, man. For my real fans. I got caught up with a Lil Zan. Can't stop me, but it slowed me, though. Yeah, nigga famous, you don't know me, though. But their DJ still play me, though.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and we're listening to Angels by Chance the Rapper. New shit from Chance about his city, Chicago. Chirac, the murder capital of America, I think. I heard a kid interviewed for a story last year who said, you can just find guns in the bushes. Like, that's a reliable way to acquire a gun in that neighborhood, is to go out and look around outside for one that someone dropped after presumably doing something bad with it. And it's an appropriate song for this week's episode, which is about communities that get erased from history. Present-day Chicago will be difficult to erase because they're having an incredible artistic explosion that Chance is leading right now, but if you're a poor neighborhood that doesn't have the luxury of having a genius putting you on the map in song, American history books especially don't like to acknowledge that sometimes America sucks at its job. There was actually a housing development in Chicago, Cabrini Green, that a friend of mine grew up in, and that got literally demolished, removed from the city of Chicago and replaced with upscale high-rise condos. And yeah, if you've read A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, you know the general shape of the stories we're talking about today. You've probably heard the saying that history is written by the winners, and the winners of America are, you know, huge corporations and rich people, presidents and the Carnegies and Rockefellers who prop them up. And today we're going to talk about the poor people and political movements that mattered in their time and then just got erased by those winners. And we're going to try to figure out what the logic is behind that process. What gets a group of people who mattered in their time just completely erased from history? Because it's not always straightforward. For instance, you can't be an ancillary victim of the bad guy. You can be the main victim, the people who died in concentration camps in World War II, or during the Red Scare, the artists and politicians who got blacklisted from Hollywood and Washington because they were falsely accused of being secret communist operatives. We remember those people. What we don't remember are the actual communists that existed in America and Hollywood, or, you know, the gangs of German teenagers that rose up against Hitler and died heroic, tragic deaths before the rise of Nazism. Those people don't fit within our version of history in which Germany just all of a sudden got swept up in Nazi fever, I guess. And the Red Scare was caused by, you know, overblown paranoia. Even when we mean well, even when we're trying to make Joseph McCarthy look like a nut bar and, you know, Nazis look terrifying, in doing so, we completely erase their enemies and their victims from the face of time. American communists during the first half of the 20th century just got written out of history because they're not convenient for telling the one fairly straightforward story we've agreed to agree is the objective truth. That accepted version of events takes on a sort of gravitational pull. You can almost see it in real time on the internet these days, like everyone agreeing on a certain opinion, and as those opinions cluster together and form a narrative, the little nuances of the story that don't fit the most straightforward elevator pitch version of the narrative get kind of sanded down into the single, conveniently easy to remember narrative. That's something the winners don't like to acknowledge when they're writing it, is that a lot of history is just nonsense that's easy to remember. Like Napoleon? Ah, short guy. which, no, not really, perfectly average height, but his enemy has made that rumor up, and short guy whose unresolved issues about his height motivate him to conquer most of Europe is a good hook. That's literally what matters. You can kind of imagine historical figures as people pitching themselves to reality TV producers. Like, what's my character hook? Okay, short, angry guy conquers Europe out of a sense of desperation. Love it. It's not actually short. Who cares? We'll paint him with tall people. Next, Depression era. President looks weak and crippled, but defeats Hitler. Professor X with a cigarette holder. Love it. We don't remember him as the racist president under whom redlining became a thing, though he was that. But that doesn't fit the story of him being a champion to the poor. And, you know, America was paranoid about communists during the Red Scare, so they must have been making all the communists up. It's like history gets written by the winners, pitched to reality show producers, and then filtered through whatever process shapes those email forwards that old people send around with the details that are just a little too perfect and easy to be true. Yeah, so that's what we're talking about today. The people who don't make it through that insane process. Interesting stories and groups of people that got erased from American history for extremely stupid reasons. Hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. City so damn great, I feel like Alexander. Wear your halo like a hat, that's like the latest fashion. I got angels all around me, they keep me surrounded. Ooh, after them, you can't touch me. Nah, 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 nah. I got angels. I got angels. I ain't changed my number since the seventh grade. This for
I
my
am
day
joined
one,
by
10 years,
Schmitty the Clam. Mr. Alex Schmidt.
I'm a clam.
Clam. I've been calling you Schmitty the Clam for no reason, just because I felt like Schmitty is like one of those old timey nicknames. And
Yeah, like I'm a prize fighter or like a like a weird political candidate or something.
Or yeah, somebody who they can't get to speak. Like, I'm a clam, you see. Never can't get
the clam.
Yeah. And Adam Todd Brown.
The Hold clam.
On. The clam. Adam the clam. If I just like and then went into a different explanation for why you're the clam.
Because he's got a pearl inside, you right. guys. Everybody's like, magic.
Yeah. Where do you want to start? We're talking about chunks of history that are forgotten that all kind of follow a similar pattern. Entire groups of people essentially who just get erased off the map of history.
Groups are communities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Communities.
It's a thing we're really good at in this country. Just taking things from people and using it for ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's how this country was founded.
Literally.
Yeah. Even if it seemed like there weren't a lot of people there, maybe many of them had died of diseases and had built cities and harbors we just kind of went into.
Nope. No. This was it was God's will that these empty towns were here for us to live in. But even present day, I was just listening to the Bill Simmons podcast, and he was talking to Malcolm Gladwell about the city of Milwaukee. The Milwaukee Bucks is their basketball team. Uh-huh. And last year, the owners, two hedge fund billionaires, both guys are worth $5 billion, threatened to take the Bucks to Seattle unless Milwaukee would pay $500 million or like many billions of dollars to build a stadium for the Bucks. And so Paul Ryan capitulated. He was like, okay, and charged the taxpayers billions of dollars to fund to build this stadium for two already billionaires. Yeah. And it's like one of those things that's so outrageous that it should be the plot of some over-the-top propaganda film, but it actually happened. And the thing Gladwell was pointing out was that nobody cared. There were two stories on it and not well-read stories at all. And then people just kind of were like, yeah. And I wonder if it's just like a psychological bias where we're like, oh, you can like be horrible to entire groups of people as long as we don't know a single one of those people. Like if we know one of those people, then they have a face and we feel bad. But if it's just Milwaukee, fuck it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah sure. Milwaukee. Sure, you evil billionaires. Like take money from, he was pointing out that they like defunded the University of Wisconsin.
right.
To like build this stupid fucking basketball stadium.
Go to hell, kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Scott Walker's tearing that apart because he's worried it's taking too much public money to keep the public colleges in Wisconsin running, which seems like a thing that's worth more than a different stadium than, what is it, the Bradley Center? Like, I think I've been to the Bradley Center.
The Bradley Center's nice. Fine. I saw a Lakers game there once. It's great.
Yeah, it's a totally functional stadium.
Those two billionaires just, like, don't like their seats or something. They're like, the boxes here are a little cramped. And we wanted to soundproof them so we could, have really weird orgies in them. Wanted to up the weirdness of our orgies.
Yeah, in their defense, the orgy scene in Milwaukee is not hopping. Yeah. You need to do something.
Absolutely true. This is just a modern example of what has been kind of a tradition of just stomping entire communities into oblivion.
Including with sports stadiums.
Yeah, four sports stadiums. Yeah, it's like, what the fuck? Like, why is this the most evil enterprise? Like, But it really does seem to be true. You wrote a recent article about Chavez Ravine, the Dodger Stadium neighborhood out here where Dodger Stadium still is to this day.
Yeah, and they still call it Chavez Ravine. It's kind of a long story, but basically what happened is Chavez Ravine at the time, if you see pictures of it from back then, it's almost like this mountain community in the middle of Los Angeles. Everything about Los Angeles is still, at that time, looks kind of like it does now. There's tall buildings, there's a lot of cars, and then there's just this part that looks like Mexico, basically. And there were like 500 people. They all owned their houses. They had businesses. They had their own schools, their own churches. And it was just like their own kind of thriving community. And they were doing good. And at one point, this guy comes in, Norris Paulson, runs for the mayor of Los Angeles. And prior to him running for mayor, there had been a plan put in place to take Chavez Ravine and just raise the buildings and put up housing projects and move the residents back in. So just basically like update their buildings, give them better roads. And Norris Paulson, after getting elected, comes in and says, no, this is Los Angeles in the 50s, so that's communism. Which, to his credit, the guy who put the plan forward was actually a communist.
Sure.
But
we're going to get to the dirty truth about America's dirty past.
There were definitely some issues with communism.
Yeah.
But this guy's particular plan was just to do that, to put up this housing project. And so what they did is they got all the residents out of there with the understanding that they'd be moved back in. And then Norris Paulson comes in and goes, nope, that's communism. That guy's going to prison. But instead, we'll sell the land back to Los Angeles at a deep discount on the grounds that they use it for public good. And they put Dodger Stadium there.
So this is like a socialist utopia.
Homeowners.
Of like immigrants that was like a thriving community, right?
Yeah, it's like if the Poltergeist house was built on top of Mexican American dreams instead of Indian graves. There's a school. There's an entire school underneath Dodger Stadium.
Because, really?
Yeah, it was easier for them when they were building Dodger Stadium. Instead of tearing the school down, they just took the roof and the floors out and left the walls and just filled it in with sand.
And school was in session when they did
that.
That's
the weirdest part. Really, really harsh. So in 500 years, when the aliens that conquer us are digging our stuff up, they're going to really think we had our priorities out of order.
Yeah.
Because we have a baseball stadium on top of a school.
Or maybe.
They're going to be like, you could have taught people how to keep us from killing you if you'd have just left that school.
Right. Or maybe they'll be huge baseball fans. Who knows?
Yeah, when you go to Dodger Stadium, it's in such a... Because like I'm a White Sox fan from around Chicago, and that stadium is not in a tremendous location. It's like on a highway almost, and you have to... And there's like not really anything around it. And most other stadiums I've been to are just sort of in a spot. It's just sort of where the stadium... Wrigley's a big exception. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But Dodger Stadium is on like this perfect hilltop... In a way that I've never seen with any stadium. It's like, wow, how did they get this wonderful place to put a thing?
Yeah, that's the problem.
To put a whole stadium.
Like, it really is the perfect place for Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, like, there's this view of downtown, and there's, like, plenty of parking for it. And it's like, oh, this is a really, I don't know, how did they get all this land in the middle of L.A. to do this?
And then you find out, and you're like, oh, I'm boycotting the Dodgers now.
Right.
Right. Turns out the community that was there had the bad luck of being... immigrants and not the home of a celebrity. Like, literally, they would have had more trouble pulling that off if, like, Cary Grant had There was one home there, and Cary Grant owned it. Like, it, because people would be like, Cary Grant, it's Cary Grant Gate. Leave Cary Grant alone.
Let him have his 500 acres in the middle of LA.
But because it's this thriving community of, wasn't it like a pretty unique community in the sense that it really was like just transported from Mexico to Los Angeles?
Because of kind of the layout of the land, it's a ravine. It's just sort of like a crater cut into the middle of LA. So everyone just had space, and there were mountains, and it just sort of looked like a different country. And I think it was the fact that everyone had space that was the problem.
Right.
They were like, oh, no, we could put buildings on that.
This is worth way too much money.
The school that's buried underneath Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, just a beautiful little elementary school that they were just like, this is where home plate goes. And this is an article that you wrote with a number of other examples, right? Like Brazil is just getting basically flattened in order to make the Olympics happen.
Yeah, what's weird about Brazil is their poor people for the longest time have lived way up in the mountains, because getting up to the mountains requires like a 7-mile walk up a mountain, which is inconvenient. And with the World Cup and the Olympics coming, what they're finding is tourists want good places to take pictures. So they're basically getting poor people out of those areas so tourists feel safe enough to go up and take really great selfies on the top of mountains. And with their crumbling infrastructure and all the problems Brazil has, they invested millions of dollars in a cable car to take people up one spot of the mountain, like of all the things you don't need. And yeah, they're just going in and destroying neighborhoods, which happens every time the Olympics come to town. Like if they're in the surrounding area where the Olympic festivities are happening, they're screwed.
Well, and those people are doubly screwed because there's the Olympics coming up in 2016, and then they had the World Cup in 2014. And so they already got the ball rolling on a lot of that and built massive stadiums that nobody wants, and then bulldozed a lot of these favelas and neighborhoods that people are able to live in, partly because they sort of don't own the land. Like, it's just sort of an understanding that the neighborhood's there and that's where the people live, so that's where it's going to be. But then when you try to legally knock that down, there's not a lot to stop you as a government, even other than morality and whatever else.
Yeah, that was actually the first podcast we had you on, Schmitty the Clam. It was about the World Cup. And
the first time I talked a lot ever. Usually a clam.
Usually exactly. We had to pry you open. That was weird. It's like the World Cup and the Olympics are excuses to show off the latest in fascist technology. Like, it's like E3 for police states, essentially. Yeah. And they're just like, look at the amazing new technology we have. Like in London in 2012, I think they had machine guns that were mounted to the sides of buildings in downtown London that could like target and shoot anything out of the sky in seconds, and they had literally every square inch of London locked down with closed circuit cameras. It really is like the latest and greatest in sort of oppressive regime wear.
And even if you're not getting kicked out of your shanty town so they can put up a stadium, when the Olympics come to town, everyone feels it. I remember in London, there was a story about how they took one of the busiest roads and just shut down like 3 lanes and reserve them only for people traveling to and from the Olympics.
Right.
So it's like, we have to get to work, mate. It's like,
there it is.
Can we?
That was an actual sound clip we pulled from my
London. Yeah, that was
a Londoner 2012.
It's timed really well.
It's a phone app I have. It pulls up interview clips on the fly. And yeah, they just shut it down so people could get to the Olympics easier. And people were like, what about us? We still live here.
When I believe I've read like one of the upcoming Olympic bids, the U.S. bid city is L.A., and I'm terrified that'll work out because L.A.'s already had 2 Olympics and seems like a good candidate.
And we're building a new stadium.
Yeah, and they're building new stadiums for the NFL, which is a whole nother thing, and a whole nother also example of St. Louis really wants to keep the Rams, and so the team is basically like, well, great, build us an entire riverfront stadium and we'll stay because they can get the public money to do it if they just push them, I guess. But either way, like the Olympics coming here or even the NFL coming here is not like, I have a hard time seeing it as a benefit even. It's just, it'll just be such a boondoggle.
Boondoggle. Good use of the word boondoggle.
I have an app that plays boondoggle when I need it.
It's almost like history operates on these weird rules that say, you can get away with doing evil shit to people in the name of sports.
I'm starting to feel like people only bid for the Olympics when they just want to gentrify a certain area of town. And they want to do it under the guise of, well, we have all these sporting events coming. But really, they're like, let's get some condos there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's bid on the Olympics, and that'll be our excuse.
You know what looked good there? Soccer stadium.
And if you listen to the people, like especially the people in Brazil, I watched there's a really great documentary on YouTube. It's like 15 minutes long about the World Cup. And they were asking the guy in the Brazilian government who was responsible for bringing all this stuff there. They were like, so who's going to use these stadiums after these events leave? And he goes, you know, people who go to events. It's like, what? Like, that doesn't count. That's not public.
That's not
use.
An answer.
That's
yeah.
a terrible. And it took him a good 30 seconds to come up with it. There was just like a steely glare where he was like, I'm going to machine gun you down after this.
Brazil, literally, like, there's videos that you can find on YouTube of, I have that show, The Spit Take, where I, like, go through just amazing clips found on YouTube, and one of the clips we deconstructed was, like, a guy on a highway in Brazil, traffic is stopped, and then a black helicopter swoops down, and a criminal runs out of a car that is, like, ahead in traffic. They machine gun him down from the helicopter, and then the person whose dashboard cam it is just starts laughing his ass off. So Brazil does not fuck around.
There's a video in the column about the World Cup where the police in Brazil, this guy was directing traffic outside his daughter's wedding, and cops almost hit him, and he just like got angry, as people do in traffic, and they get out, push him to the side of the sidewalk, and shoot him in the head.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And it takes like a minute and a half tops to go from him saying, please don't hit me with your car, to, okay, we'll shoot you in the head instead.
Jesus Christ.
And that guy felt really comfortable shooting him in the head. You could tell. He was like, I'm not going to jail for this.
Fifth time today. Yeah. Head rolling back, but I'm faking the rush. Out every night and I'm lonely as fuck. I make my own rooms in my own place. I got no room. Hey guys, we're riding into the break on It's Strange by Louis the Child featuring Kay Flay. It's a dope song. Louis the Child are two dudes from also Chicago. They're the DJ. Kay Flay is the gal singing on the track. I'm playing it because I like it. And hey, this episode is history, and Louis the Child is named after a 10th century Frankish king who ruled over most of Europe at age 7. And was a huge fan of big dramatic dubsteppy drops like this. Guys, let's say a prayer. A prayer for fallen running backs. Jamal Charles, we hardly knew ye. Le'Veon Bell, you were lost, but then you were found. Now you're lost again. I clearly don't know anything about how prayers work, but what I'm trying to say is, what the hell is going on with injuries this year? It seems like every single person who got drafted in the first round is now out for the rest of the season, and that sucks for fantasy. It sucks in reality, sucks in fantasy, but just because Jamal Charles and your yearly fantasy team are done for the year, that doesn't mean you have to be out for the year. That's why you should check out DraftKings, where you get to redraft your team every week with real, live, not injured players. You can compete in leagues with thousands of players, create a custom league for just you and your friends, or go head-to-head against someone for just a buck. They're crowning a new millionaire every week this season. So hurry to DraftKings.com now and use promo code CRACKED to play free for a shot in this Sunday's $1 million fantasy football contest, where first place takes home 100 grand. So once again, DraftKings.com and use promo code CRACKED. This week's episode is also sponsored by Lynda.com. Lynda is the home to over 3,000 courses on topics like photography, web design, graphic design, audio production, video production, and training for any software you might need in the professional world. They also have courses on boring stuff like business and money. I know it's not as sexy as a course like creating dubstep drums, which actually exists. But if you're trying to start your own business or do your own taxes, get a new job, or just be better at the job you have, there are classes on Lynda designed to really help you succeed with the less glamorous stuff that we all need to be good at. Take Excel, for example. Lynda has tons of courses on Excel. Everyone should know how to use Excel. And even if you do know Excel, if you took a Lynda course on it, you definitely learn something new that makes your life way easier. I should definitely take a class on Excel so I can stop managing my finances on a ledger like an old-timey 1920s businessman. So here's my offer just for you guys. Go to lynda.com/cracked and you can get a 10-day free trial with unlimited access to every single course on lynda.com. So go ahead, guys, learn something new or get better at something you already know how to do by starting a 10-day free trial at lynda.com/cracked. That's lynda.com/cracked. All right, but we don't want to only talk about soccer stadiums necessarily. There's also kind of a big history of just entire communities being erased. And I kind of want to try and figure out what the logic is for how can you tell if your little chunk of history, your little community that you live in, is going to just disappear from the face of time? Like, it is like internet humor going to just be like nobody's gonna remember, like, for whatever reason?
We need to start printing this stuff out.
Yeah, podcasts.
Yeah, can we carve it into stone? That would be great.
And it's like kind of accidental in some cases. When I was growing up, calling someone a communist was a joke. It was like a funny thing that was like synonymous with what we thought old people would accuse each other of if they were crazy. Like, it would be like, I think you're secretly an alien. I think you're a pinko commie, you weirdo. Like, it wasn't a serious thing, but there was a lot of communism throughout the 20th century, just like incidental communism. But because of the Red Scare and like Joseph McCarthy, we remember it only as like this fabricated thing. But there actually were communists who, there was a communist party, and there's this novel Native Son by Richard Wright that is about race, but, you know, two of the characters, it's set in the 1920s, and two of the characters just happen to be communists. And it's like, wait, what? That's like not a thing that could ever happen today. Yeah. Or even a thing, like, when I read that novel, I was just surprised that that even existed.
Today, that's what the book would be about, if there's a communist character.
Yeah.
It's like, look at this nut.
Yeah, it's just not a thing that's taken seriously, or even a part of history anymore. We had this pitch in an editorial meeting this week where it was about screenplays that were written by great geniuses and never produced, which is too specific a premise, so we're rejiggering it. But one of them was a screenplay written by Ayn Rand in the early 20th century that was deemed by Hollywood too critical of communism, which you always hear about, like The Blacklist and like there being a witch hunt to sniff out the commies in the 40s and 50s. But there actually was a commie-friendly vibe that was there before that. So it's almost like if you get stomped out in dramatic enough fashion, or if the people who rise up and end up defeating you are like the villains of history, then you will disappear because you're not convenient for telling their story, I guess.
I feel like with communism, I think part of the reason we treat it like it's such a joke now, because back then, like, communism was the enemy. That's one of the things we were fighting against. And it would be like now if Alex the Clam here sat down and was like, hey, guys, I joined Al-Qaeda this weekend. We'd be like, what? That's crazy. And that's how it was back then with communism.
Well, before World War II, they weren't the enemy. And I think that's what I find surprising, is that communism was just a thing. You were part of the Green Party or whatever.
Right.
I'm an environmentalist. Ah, I'm a communist. Nice to meet you. But back then, before the Cold War, nobody gave a shit because it was just like a different political ideology. And it's just once the Cold War started, it just like changes everything to these stark blacks and whites. And the idea of communism being actually taken seriously by people is just like stamped out. It's like erased from history.
Yeah. Well, and also especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the big fear was anarchism. Like socialism and communism were seen as maybe tied to that partly, but more of a philosophy that, oh, these people have a kind of an interesting thought. But anarchism was the big fear, especially because of it creating strikes, and there were various bombings and riots and things like that.
Yeah, no, the guy who shot the president, who Roosevelt was the vice president to, right? Was McKinley.
McKinley, yeah.
Yeah, the assassin was an anarchist.
Yeah,
and the closest that I have to an actual vision of anarchists are Flea and Big Lebowski. Like the, we believe in Nothing Lebowski. They're just like comedic characters, but that was like a major problem that all the heads of states like put their heads together to be like, how do we deal with this anarchist problem?
And America's eventual solution, because that fear particularly blew up while World War I was happening. It was something people were very terrified of. And nobody remembers that there were people passing laws against it. There was the Espionage Act in 1917 was passed, so it made it so anything you did that interfered with the U.S. military was illegal and treasonous. And then the Immigration Act of 1918 expanded it to, it set rules for bringing people into the country, but also that you could deport people for opposing organized government, which was just a specific legal. If you're an anarchist, you can get booted out of the country. And then after the Palmer raids, which are named after the attorney general at the time, they rounded up thousands of people who they suspected of anarchism and being against the government. And then they took about 250 of them and put them on a ship called the USAT Buford that they nicknamed the Soviet Ark. And then these people were just shipped to Russia to get them out of the country. Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and these other anarchists. America's decision was basically, you are deported. You're out. You're just getting put on this boat and getting sent to revolutionary Russia. Because crazy. We don't want you here anymore. And we just can do that in the name of national security.
Wow. And those people just showed up and they were like, we don't speak Russian. Like, right. What's it like? This really sucks for us. Yeah. There's also this movie called The Swing Kids that Christian Bale is in from like, I think it's the early 90s, that literally nobody went to see because it's about a type of group that we don't like to make room for, which is a anti-Nazi group of Germans who like protested against Hitler and were like kind of badasses and like danced and partied and fought Hitler. And it's like, no, we like Germany when they're all Nazis. Like that's the version of Germany that we want to see. So one of Christian Bale's first movies is this movie that like literally nobody saw because it isn't the version of Nazism that we like to...
Well, it could also be, if I'm gathering correctly from the synopsis, they're fighting Nazism with swing music.
That's the other problem.
That could have been part of the problem.
That's the other thing that will get you erased quickly as a social group, swing music, if all you do everything with swing music. Who else have we stamped from history?
In terms of socialism, I feel like now as Bernie Sanders runs for president and is asked about being a socialist, that hasn't been a very common thing with national candidates, but I think it's treated as a thing like that's never happened before. There's never been even a socialist candidate or a socialist movement all in the country. And regardless of whether socialism's a good idea, I think there was like a major party for it in particular in the 10s and 20s. And even after that, this guy, Eugene Debs from Indiana, ran for president 5 times and was a major third party candidate, 4 of them. In 1912, he got 6% of the vote, which was almost 1 million people. And then in 1920, he'd been jailed for opposing the draft for World War I, and he ran for president from jail and got almost 1 million votes, which is very hard to do when you're a prisoner.
From experience.
Yeah, you know, when I was jailed for being in Al-Qaeda, they didn't let me. But it was a thing that had a lot of support in a lot of parts of the country, but we don't talk about that as being a major thing, partly because we're very focused on the two parties in history that we've generally had in one name or another, but I don't know why it's something that gets totally ignored because it's fascinating.
Yeah, I wonder how arbitrary it is. Like, would we have forgotten about the Whigs or the Democrats if that had been Russia's jam? If Russia, you know, like, because it was just like, oh, well, this happens to be the other world power and they believe in this thing. So that's the enemy. We were never into that. And I'm sure a lot of history gets rewritten, retconned to fit whatever the current narrative is, the anti-communism thing.
Yeah, and I think it all gets viewed in whatever's going on. Like, the easiest touchstone for me to bring up with Debs is Sanders, because they're both people who say they're socialists and running for president. And so before Sanders was running, I probably would have viewed it some other way, maybe.
You guys want to talk about the worst race riots in American history?
Let's talk about Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay, you do your race riots, and then I'll do mine.
That sounds awful. Yeah. Sounded really bad. Can we just get a clip of that circulated on the internet? There's a section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, I think it's still technically a neighborhood there, called Greenwood, that back in the early 20s was referred to as the Black Wall Street. Tulsa, as you can imagine, was super segregated in the 1920s, and everyone was poor because the Depression was looming. There were, like, the Klan was everywhere, and this one section of Tulsa, it was almost completely self-sufficient. Everyone was relatively affluent. There were black businesses, black homes, black schools, hospitals, parks, everything. It was the richest black neighborhood in the country. And one day, a kid who lived in Greenwood, he was a black kid, he was walking into an elevator, and he got accused of sexual assault, basically. And the police investigated. They determined that all that happened was he tripped and startled the girl. She screamed, and someone called the police. So they determined there was no crime.
Right, sexual assault, right.
Right, right, exactly. But nevertheless, the white people in the surrounding areas were like, no, we should probably lynch him anyway. So they gathered at the courthouse to demand that the police hand this kid over, because the police, for a refreshing change, are kind of the good guys in this story. They, like, did a really thorough, quick investigation, immediately knew it was garbage, and they were like, no, you can't lynch him. He didn't do anything. And people were like, "Nah, let's err on the side of caution and just do it anyway." And what happened is people in Greenwood, a lot of them veterans from World War I who had moved to Greenwood, they were like, you know what, we're not going to let another person get lynched. So they armed themselves and went and confronted this mob. And when that happened, it set off a riot that ended with white people from all these surrounding areas just streaming into this Greenwood neighborhood, and they burned it completely to the ground. They burned the hospitals to the ground. The hospitals. So we don't even know how many people died, because if there were medical records or anything, all of that's gone. It's suspected that there's probably, like, mass graves somewhere in Tulsa, because people would have just built shit over them, because we went decades without even caring that this happened. It's still not a thing that gets talked about a lot. There's a picture in this article that I linked to in the column, and it looks like the apocalypse. And in whatever, I don't know how people put captions on pictures in the 1920s, but it says, "Running the Negro out of Tulsa," and it's got a date. And it's just a picture of devastation and smoke.
It feels like that isn't accidental that we forget about, that there was this thriving community. Like, for the same reason, like, it's not accidental that Chavez Ravine was a thriving community of immigrants, and this was a thriving community of African Americans, and that doesn't fit with the overall sort of narrative that America likes to put forth or remember. And therefore, it's just really easy for them to just kind of burn it down and then just, like, kick dirt over it.
Yeah.
Like, and just be like, nah, nothing to see here. And, like, we're just like, okay, sure.
And I wonder if it's partly because we hate talking about, because, like, talking about that story means talking about inequality. And it's just, that's hard to face. And it's, in particular, in that case, not fixable. It's happened, and it's been horrible, and it's maybe easier for us to all let that go because it's just such a tragedy.
Yeah, but the riots that get passed down and put in history books are like the Watts riots, where it's and the LA riots, where it's the
where black, the black people are doing the rioting
and when it's the white people doing the rioting, we're just like, well, that doesn't compute.
Ignore, delete.
That's also the deadliest race riot on record that they didn't destroy the records for, was in New York City during the Civil War, and it was white people rioting because they had just announced that black people didn't have to be drafted to fight in the Civil War. And they were like, well, that's not fair. Race riot. Worst race riot ever.
That seems,
like,
really fair.
Fucking tore Manhattan down, and nobody talks about it. Nobody remembers it because, again, it's white people being angry at black people.
Yeah, it does fit the narrative that, that the Civil War had a lot to do with slavery. So then that is hard for someone who doesn't want that to be a thing to deal with. And then also it doesn't fit the narrative of, like, the Union was fighting to, like, the whole Union was united to stop slavery. There, like, were people who were like, no, I don't want to fight for this. I don't want to be in a war for this, you know, tied up in it.
Yeah. It's like we want to believe in some cartoonish version of history where it's Southern whites were the only bad guys and they're the only people who are racist in movies from history for the most part.
Right.
You know, you don't have entire groups of Northeastern white people being horrible racists.
Speaking of New York, I mentioned this right before we came in, but Seneca Village was one of the first settlements of freed black slaves. It sprung up in New York, and they were mostly, again, like homeowners. Actually, at the time, you had to own $250 worth of land to vote. So most of the black people in the area who could afford to buy land went to the Seneca Village area and bought land, so it gave them like the right to vote and whatnot. And it was, again, like a thriving community. They were getting along just fine. And we decided we needed a park because Europe's biggest cities all had parks. And someone said they were the lungs of the city. Mm. So we needed a park. And they decided that they would tear down Seneca Village because it's a shanty town is what how they described it. And by that, they meant that's where the black people live. So they basically just used eminent domain to go in and take these homes from everyone in Seneca Village, and they put Central Park there. But on the bright side, there's a plaque.
There is a plaque.
There's a plaque in Central Park.
One of 10,000 right. plaques in Central Park.
That feels more like a taunt.
Right.
Like, hey, don't forget, we will tear your shit down and put right. a park here.
Yeah, I was going to say earlier, you know what would look good there? A soccer stadium, and then that's Central Park. What are you talking about? Like that, I could see that happening in the future, like just New York vying for the Olympics. Right. But that's crazy that that literally happened.
Yeah.
That's how Central Park was built.
Yeah, it's built on top of a former settlement. Sad. Harsh, man. Jesus. We are harsh. In my homes, in my own place, I got no room for no man. That's my way.
That's my way. Hey guys, I want you to open up a new browser tab or pull out your phone and go to something called libertyvan.com. As some of you are noticing right now, this is probably the worst website in the entire history of the internet, which is actually a pretty hard thing to pull off. For those of you choosing to miss out on this madness, let me describe it to you. It's a website devoted to two minivans that are covered bumper to bumper in absolutely batshit insane bumper stickers. Most of them seemingly arguing that smoking doesn't kill you, but the website itself is a sight to be seen. The text like spills over and covers the pictures, the font color and size changes without any rhyme or reason. It's like they accidentally wrote it in ransom letter font. It's horrendous and gets everything about websites wrong. So don't be like libertyvan.com. Use Squarespace, whether you need a website for your business, your portfolio, your blog, or even your bumper sticker cars. Squarespace provides simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed regardless of your skill level. They give you 24/7 online support and a beautiful website for only $8 a month. You can even get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. So yeah, what are you guys waiting for? Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. And we and Squarespace command you to build it beautiful. Schmitty, you wanted to talk about how the German experience is worse than any immigrant population's ever been treated in America, right? that was your thesis?
Guys, this is why I'm a clam, okay? This is why it's this kind of treat. No, and I think it probably ties into what we talked about before with how, you know, Russia being the enemy has probably shaped our view of a lot of history with Germany being the enemy in two world wars. The size and scope of German people and culture in America was kind of forgotten, and also German culture was sort of swept away due to internal and external pressure of Germany being the enemy in world wars. But it makes people forget how big that community was. In 1900, there were 76 million people in America, and 8 million of them were German or German-American. It was the biggest ethnic group in the country at the turn of the century, but you don't think of that as being a major thing. And in 1890, the population of Milwaukee was 70% German or German-American. In St. Louis, that was 60% of the city. At the turn of the century, if you took Chicago's German population, that would have been the sixth largest city in Germany. Just those people in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Other people. Yeah.
Chicago still feels very German to me.
Yeah, it's got a big Polish, German, Czech population, and then also the South Side, a lot of Irish roots, too. Yeah.
I've always said I can smell a German from two blocks away.
But as that community would grow and grow, there were lots of German and German-American people who were important figures in America. There was also a lot of Midwestern German folks who were the kind of early backbone of the Republican Party, like the Lincoln Free Soil became the Republican Party. But the U.S. wasn't in World War I for very long, but that tension and then eventually being in the war is something that sort of ended that community. Because we entered the war in 1917, but when Germany invaded Belgium in 1914, it was known worldwide as the Rape of Belgium, and it was this thing where Germany had done all these horrible things, some true, some not, in Belgium. And then the sinking of the Lusitania was bad, the Zimmermann telegram was bad. There were all sorts of things that made Germany the enemy of America in that war, and then being seen as too German became problematic for people in the U.S.
That was going to be my note in your performance review this year. Too German. Right. No, that is really interesting, and something I'd never thought of is Italians have Columbus Day, Irish people have St. Patrick's Day. England has all the money and power still. Just the first people were like, we're going to take all the power and nobody else gets to be president. But yeah, Germany doesn't, they have Oktoberfest, which is like, go over to Germany if you want to fucking celebrate drinking beer and like delicious pies. The things that Americans love most, they're like, yeah, well, we don't celebrate that here. I've never heard of a community, actually Cincinnati, I lived near Cincinnati for a while, and like that has a big German population, and they did,
yeah, a lot of the Midwest is,
yeah, they did a big Oktoberfest thing, but it was just like a thing that happened in the parks. You didn't like get off from school or something.
Yeah, the closest thing I can think of is there's a Polish guy in Illinois. We get his
Kazimierz Pulaski.
Everyone gets his birthday off at school in Illinois.
It's really?
Like, it's a Casimir
specifically. It's a like specifically Chicago area holiday where you get. I think it's in March. There's a Sufjan Stevens song that references the date because also he's into like Illinois minutia. But he was a Polish hero in the Revolutionary War, and then so the big Polish population in Chicago makes a point of it being a holiday.
Yeah, I remember I was in like fourth grade, and one day they were like, "Hey, you get this new day off now." I was like, "Who's this guy? I don't care. Yeah.
Right,
I'm going home."
And you guys could have literally just been making up random syllables when you just said blank, blank, blank day. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sure. Sure thing. Yeah. I bet they really do give you off for that.
And the book I was reading about, I think, said that in the 2010 census, it was 49.8 million Americans identified as having some kind of German heritage, which is like a sixth of the country. That's a lot of people. But the only German-American celebration I knew about growing up is that one parade in Ferris Bueller's Day Off that he like hijacked. There's like people in kind of lederhosen and stuff. And that turns out was like a Von Steuben Day celebration also is like a super, super local Chicago thing is not a major holiday at all.
And the injustice of that movie is that they didn't get off for Von Steuben Day.
There's only 85 school days in Chicago. The rest are just Polish holidays.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Just street parades with fucking... Yeah.
Beyond the lack of, we're going to have this big German-American event, like as in the 1910s and then after that as the problem of, we're at war with Germany, maybe we shouldn't have it be a big thing in communities here in the country. A lot of other things that were part of German culture and language kind of went away. There's this book called Burning Beethoven about sort of just the whole process of German America becoming less so, specifically in World War I. And he talks about how there were a lot of German language newspapers in the country. And this is when people read the newspaper. That was a big thing. And in 1910, there were 488 German language newspapers, and they reached 3.3 million people. And that was 54% of all foreign language newspapers in the country were in the German language, which boggles the mind today. No one even speaks German. It's a dumb language with three genders. It's crazy. It's not a dumb language. I shouldn't say that. But then, so 1910. In 1910, there were these 488 papers. By 1920, there were 152 of them, with about a third of the circulation they used to have. And then by 1930, there were 10 of them. It just completely went away as a thing. And it was also partly that under the Espionage Act, there was some censorship of these papers because they were saying, oh, by having a German language newspaper, you're sort of aiding the enemy in some way, was an argument that local authorities could make. And then a lot of these papers had to deal with that being trouble.
I was just about to say, you kraut, like, like, I shouldn't be able to say that, right? That's like, isn't that like a, probably a racist term or something that is just okay?
Because it's Germans.
Because it's Germans, we just don't give a fuck. We're like, whatever. Yeah.
Right, well, because German culture is like so not a thing in America anymore that it's like kind of a gag. It's like not something you just have to worry about being a thing, And also, educating people in speaking the German language went away a lot because of internal pressure, people being not wanting to seem too part of what was, you know, the enemy of the country. But in 1918, New York City schools just canceled teaching German, even though, if nothing else, you want to know the language of the enemy, you know what I mean? You want to know what they're saying to each other. There were also university professors and university programs canceled or shut down for just being the German program. There were three professors at the University of Nebraska who were just fired for not being patriotic enough, people thought, and they were all professors teaching German. And then there were also libraries in Detroit, Denver, St. Louis, New York, Cleveland, Portland, and D.C. that banned having German books in their library because it was seen as part of, well, let's help the war effort and not have too many German books around at this time. But there were also, just in German families, I obviously was not alive then, but I'm a big Kurt Vonnegut fan, and in he has a book called Palm Sunday that's sort of an autobiography of his life. And both sides of his family, or the Vonneguts and the Liebers, were like old German families in Indianapolis, Indiana. And he talks about how, as the First World War was happening, they didn't want to like be too German. They didn't want to make too much of a point of still doing that. And there's a quote where he says that the anti-Germanism in this country during the First World War so shamed and dismayed my parents that they resolved to raise me without acquainting me with the language or the literature or the music or the oral family histories which my ancestors had loved. And he grew up basically without that being a part of his family. And then also his mother's side was a big brewer. They ran a, I think it was called Lieber Gold beer. It was like this big brewer. And Prohibition wiped them out. The whole source of family income was gone because that hit them hard. And there's this book, Burning Beethoven, partly argues that Prohibition was finally implemented because it was something that was seen as kind of striking at the German community.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because it finally went through Congress in late 1917 because we were at war. It was time. And there were propaganda posters from the time. There's one from Ohio that it's a picture of like an American doughboy pointing at you. And he's saying, will you back me or back booze? And there were political cartoons. There was one that said it was about Hun rule, and it depicts a bunch of German guys who are the Hun Rule Association as walking barrels of beer with big mustaches on them. Because people strongly associated German people in America with alcohol. And there were also other movements against alcohol in America, but it sort of became an anti-war thing in the late 1910s.
Why didn't they just swing dance their way into American history books like the swing kids? Damn it. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's just like a portion of American history that just like total blank space in my mind.
It's interesting to me, since we're building all this goodwill about the Germans, if I could circle back to the Holocaust for a second. and also talk about the Kardashians.
Yeah.
Which one's worse, you guys?
The second biggest Holocaust in history was the Armenian Holocaust.
Yeah.
That's actually how the Kardashian family ended up here. They, if you can believe this, had this wacky spiritual advisor back when the Ottoman Empire was about to crumble, mm-hmm. who wrote a prophecy at the age of 12, even though he was illiterate, and said, hey, at some point in the future, we're all going to have to go to America because this place is going to be chaos.
Wow.
By the way, sorry, you can read all about this in our most popular article, Top 5 Biggest Holocausts
yes.
of All Time.
Yeah.
This is number two, the number two entry.
Most underrated Holocausts.
Proceed.
And he came back as an elder and was like, hey, that thing I wrote when I was 12, it's going to happen like right now, so let's get out of here. And he convinced these 2,000 people to flee, and that's like the Kardashian ancestors were among those people. That's how they ended up here.
That's incredible.
But what's weird is the Armenian genocide, they estimate anywhere from like 800,000 to 1.5 million Armenians were killed. And it happened in what is present-day Turkey.
Yeah.
And the Turkish government refuses to call it a genocide. They're like, no, that's not the right word for it. Like, it was a systematic thing where they went in, and in the first wave, it was like right before World War I, they killed all the able-bodied men in the Armenian community. They either killed them or sent them off to work in labor camps until they died. And then a few years later, they took the rest of the Armenian population and literally marched them into the Syrian desert with no supplies, no shelter, no nothing. They were just like, get out. Go to the Syrian desert. They're death marches. Millions of people died there. And to this day, Turkey is like, that's kind of a strong word for it. Like, I don't think it's a genocide. Like, they're the only people who don't recognize it as a genocide because it happened there. That was the whole thing. The Ottoman Empire lost 85% of its land after the First Balkan War. And the Muslim population decided, well, this is where we can go. But unfortunately, there's millions of Armenians there. So we need to do something about that. And that's how Turkey basically became a country. So it's not surprising that they don't want to go, no, we genocided our way into becoming the Republic of Turkey. But still, it's crazy that they just act like it did not happen.
Good choice of naming your country, though, Turkey, by the way.
Yeah, because no one's going to see that atrocity coming. Right. Like, oh, Turkey, that's amazing.
What a bunch of silly. And obviously, we live on top of a huge...
Right.
genocide and, you know, apocalypse with the plagues that wiped out the Native Americans.
Well, and it might be apocryphal, but I think I've read a Hitler quote where he, in talking about the Holocaust, said that nobody remembers the Armenians or the Redskins. We can probably do this thing we're going to do because nobody remembers these previous genocides in history.
Yeah, and the Armenian thing didn't happen too much before the German Holocaust. It was like 30 years or something. It wasn't...
It's crazy that Hitler was like, as he was doing it, he was like, this is sort of like that other thing that happened. Man, people are going to totally forget about that because of this really bad thing I'm doing right now.
And now
he totally had perspective on how fucking evil he was.
Now he's in a time machine somewhere like, I overdid it.
Yeah.
I really pushed the line. They remember mine.
Yeah. Every time I look into the history of America before Columbus arrived, I find out more interesting stuff. Like, there were these huge cities with pyramids bigger than the ones in Egypt. They still exist in the Mexican jungle. And, you know, the only time you hear about them is when people are suggesting that aliens helped build them, because it couldn't have possibly been the culture that was here before Columbus arrived. And they had these huge cities that were essentially like theme parks, like Disneyland. They invented Disneyland before Disney. Like, people would come to these huge opulent cities with like all these statues and really just ornate sculptures and buildings and just like observe it. Nobody lived there. It was just like a really badass thing. And I always assumed and had learned that the reason we don't know much about them is because they didn't have any written language, but that's not true. Like, many of them had written language and like symbols that we just like never bothered to write down. And so it's like a closed system. It's like we don't have the Rosetta Stone that tells us what the different things mean. But like, before anyone wrote anything down, there was this Native American civilization that was using knots in ropes, like in belts, to basically write messages to people. The length of the braid and like the knot in it, that's what they used instead of letters, which was way more durable than like a piece of paper. You just give it to someone, they tie it around their waist and then like show up and give it to the person, and that person can read the message. But it's just like, we pave over that entire whole portion of history with just like, you know, cowboys and Indians. They were the bad guys in the cowboy movies.
Well, an opera, and I'm most of the way through reading 1491 right now,
yeah.
And it's incredible, and just spells out a lot of that. Not only did we vastly underestimate the number of people that were here, but then also assume that that many people would live in one place and not put together cities, writing, governments. Like, they were just all in tents or something like that. Like, there were huge civilizations here that we just forget about.
Yeah, we just moved in. The first writings, like the primary documents that were created by the people who came over on the Mayflower are like, yeah, we used these bowls and plates that the people who are like dead in their bed had made for us. Thanks for God's providence. Like, they just literally moved into dead people's homes and were like, man, this is great how God provided these already planted cornfields.
Right.
Good thing. And, you know, the Native American who showed up and, like, helped them out was willing to help them because he had just lost his entire town to an apocalypse, essentially. It was like, I am legend, essentially. And we retell the story that they were, like, friendly Indians who, you know, were just peaceful and lived in the woods and, you know, were kind of hippies. Like, they sat around forest fires and lived in yurts. And the truth is, like, the reason that there's a 150-year gap between Columbus coming over and the Mayflower coming over is because there were, like, these huge developed civilizations in America that everyone was like, well, we can't go there because they will kick the living shit out of us. And, like, we can't make it across the Atlantic with, like, enough firepower. We'll just make do with Scotland, I guess. And, like, everybody was too terrified. And then disease eventually just wiped out 95% of the population before any white person even, like, saw them. So, like, the version that we have is this apocalypse that it is, like, drawing conclusions about New York City from the movie I Am Legend, being like, well, it was this population of, like, one dude and his dog, and thanks for God's providence.
Yeah, there were just large metal structures with wheels on them, just
right.
placed everywhere.
Right.
Very mysterious. I don't know why they did that.
That was our episode. Hope you enjoyed something and learned it. We're listening to I Keep Forgetting Every Time You're Near by Michael McDonald, my favorite singer whose voice always seems to be on the verge of being a cartoon voice or like he's making fun of a different singer. Anyways, it's about forgetting stuff, just like this episode. On to footnotes. If you're interested in learning more about what we talked about, Adam's article that goes into detail about Chavez Ravine is called Four Thriving Communities That Rich People Destroyed on Purpose. Weird that we felt the need to explain it was on purpose. On a whim, might have made sense, but I probably got distracted at the end of writing that title, maybe. You can read more about the Native Americans in my article, Six Ridiculous Lies You Probably Believe About the Founding of America. And I highly recommend A People's History of America. Great read. I just wanted to say it was going to blow your hair back, and I think that's because Matt Damon recommends it in those words in Good Will Hunting, or like knock you on your ass or something. Anyways, what else? 1491 is a great book about what America was like before the arrival of Columbus. Many huge advanced cities. I actually interviewed the author of that book, Charles Mann, for an upcoming episode of my How series, Good Question, or Good Question. We'll be dropping Ep 2 at some point in the next couple weeks, and we're riding out on Common People by Pulp, which feels like an appropriate song for this episode for obvious reasons. It's about a fancy lady who wants to sleep with the singer because he's a commoner, he's regular people, and, you know, the adventure he takes her on. If you like it, go buy it on Apple Music, and hey, while you're there, maybe give us a 5-star rating on the good old iTunes. That gets us all up on the charts and helps other people find us and makes us that much less likely to be forgotten by history. Thanks to engineer Brett Rader, who you can follow Twitter-wise at Brett Rader. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien, and we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then. She said, I want to live like common people. I want to do whatever common people do. Want to sleep with common people. I want to sleep with
I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I just started somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people? Wanna see whatever common people see? Wanna sleep with common people? You wanna sleep with common people like me? But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand.
Hey guys, just a reminder that today's episode was brought to you by lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at lynda.com. Whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design, no matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to lynda.com/crack today. That's lynda.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. Thanks, Lynda, and thanks for listening.
Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period. It's not a question, it's a statement. It's also the name of a podcast on Wolf Pop. So if you're foolish enough to disagree, listen so we can tell you how wrong you are. I'm Kevin Avery, and each week, W. Kamau Bell and I put out a new episode where we review every Denzel movie in alphabetical order, sorta, kinda. Look, we jump around a lot, all right? We're gonna do that. We're gonna catch you up on the latest Denzel news and even speculate on who would be the next Denzel. All with great guests like Omar Dorsey from the movie Selma and director Ava DuVernay. Listen to this recent clip.
I like Training Day a lot. It's one of my favorite. If it's on TV, I'm gonna sit down and watch it. But I think for a lot of people, they want to make it's like a guilty pleasure Denzel Washington
Red Velvet
because
cake.
He's playing such an unredeemable character.
It's Red Velvet Cake. You can't eat that
it's
every
red,
day.
It's Red Velvet Cake, yes. Exactly.
Man.
Eat it during Christmas. You can't have that all the time.
Yeah.
So tune into Kamau and I every week on iTunes, Wolf Pop, Howl, or your favorite podcast app, and you too will understand why Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period. Any questions?
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.